Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebel. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hey guys, we're back. And today with me, I have a copywriter. His name is Jonathan Kranz, and I love talking about copy. So I'm super pumped to have you on.
Well, thanks, Tom. I'm excited too. I have no idea what you're going to ask me. I'm completely unprepared. I'm here in my shorts and t-shirt, and I'm ready to roll with whatever you send my way.
Yeah, I've looked over your website, and you know, in the beginning, I'm like, oh, it's super simple, you know, like just a bunch of blog posts. But then I look at your client list.
Yes.
And the client list is super impressive.
Well, thanks, Tom. I'm going to challenge you with something. What do you guess is the most popular page on my website, the one that with visits and that I actually get feedback on that people comment about?
Well, the one that I leaned to was the bio. I just wanted to get into who you are, but I've seen the 10 reasons not to hire me. And
that's the one.
And that made me
that's
laugh
the one.
A lot.
That's the one. That's it. And I think that's a good way to start this conversation, because, you know, let's talk about that for a second. So why is that so successful? Well, you know, everyone does in about me, right? And then everyone's committed to something. Everyone's passionate about something. And all the rest of us who read this just roll our eyes, right? It's the same old, same old. So when I approached this, I thought, you know, I need to have some kind of statement out there for people. I thought, why not zag where everyone zigs? And I thought, instead of doing the list about why to hire me, flip it on its head, make it more interesting, and provoke people by saying, well, here's 10 reasons why you shouldn't hire me. And people go, what? And, you know, so it's kind of a clickbaity thing at first, right? So you go, I don't know, you know, this is kind of funny, 10 reasons not to hire me. And then you click on it. And then, of course, as you go in, and the 10 reasons not to hire me are, of course, 10 reasons why you should hire me, because I ask a lot of questions, because I take strategy seriously, et cetera, et cetera. And I think people just enjoy that kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek, funny approach that flips the assumptions on its head. And also what it does, too, is it weeds out people I don't want to work with. If you didn't find that funny or interesting, we probably won't get along. So, you know, find the other copywriters. So it's a win-win for everybody.
I actually love it. One of the things I usually do with the clients that come to me is tell them why they should not work with me.
Yeah.
But I've
then
never...
And what do you tell them?
Well, I tell them, like, you know, if you want someone that's going to coast, take your money.
Right.
Just do the basic stuff, not ask questions, just, you know, under the radar, hope that you pay me every month and just, you know, like disappear like a fly on the wall. That's not me. That's not me at all. Like, I will push back every single time. But I've never even thought about setting up a page like this on the website. I mean, it's brilliant.
Wow. Well, thanks. But, you know, go ahead and feel free to borrow the idea. I won't be upset. You could say, I know, 10 misgivings you might have about working with Tom or something like that. I won't, you know, I'll give you a pass.
You'll give me a pass? That was going to be my next question. Like, do you mind if I just sort of borrow this idea? Because it's really
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. Early on in my career, Tom, since we're still talking about web copy, you know, I thought one easy kind of search engine optimization gimmick that actually had real value, kind of a cross between search engine optimization and content, was I should do a glossary of copywriting terms, because I noticed that didn't really exist on the web, that people didn't know what a Johnson box was, for example, or, you know, call to action. I mean, this is basic stuff, but a lot of people didn't know. So I thought, well why don't I create this glossary? And it's twofold. One is it's a search engine magic, or I hoped it would be, you know, because I got these keywords loaded up, but also, you know, I'm doing a service. It's content, right? I'm providing something of value. Well, you know, it didn't do gangbusters. It's okay. I don't even remember that page still exists on my site. But what the interesting thing is, I was plagiarized by a journalist in the Midwest. This woman just literally almost just took everything I had word for word, the glossary, posted it up herself. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. In the age of the internet where it takes me 2 seconds to find out who's copied my stuff. Really, woman, you know, at least show some initiative. You know what I mean? But there you are.
Well, my little pushback on that is that book, was it like The Great Artist Steal or like Mediocre Artist Copy and Great Artist Steal? Maybe she just read that and she's like, you know what? I'm a great artist. I'm just taking this.
Yeah, I guess so. Right. Exactly. Right. She's like, why not just steal it right out? But that's probably her only claim to being a great artist is her capacity for theft. I didn't see anything else that merited attention. So, enough about her.
Yeah, usually it's not copied word for word, but I think ideas.
Yeah.
Ideas are good to steal, especially if they're in a different industry. And no one's really trying it in yours. I find, especially for ads and things like that, it works very well.
Oh, do you have examples of some ideas you got from other industries that you applied to marketing?
I'd have to think of them a little. But I mean, what I do is when I swipe ads, right, from just a variety of different industries, and a lot of them are very far from what my clients do. And sometimes I'll just see something and I'll change a couple things around. Actually, there is one which we've used on our own campaign. There were two pictures, a before and after, of a guy.
Uh-huh.
And it's a diet ad, right? And it pretty much said, like, in the last 30 days of his diet, Mike lost a month, right? So we just changed that to, in the last 30 days of online course marketing, Mike lost a month, right? Which is, we just moved from diet to trying to do online course marketing by yourself.
Right, great.
So things like that, just taking stuff from a whole different, you know, industry. And I think that's a good, you know, way to steal and test things. Because, I mean, that person doesn't care. Well, they're not in online course marketing.
Right. And, you know, you inspired me with a thought recently. So I live in a very small town called Ayer, Massachusetts, AYER. And there's no reason for anyone to know about this town. It's that small. See, kind of the edge of the boonies. I call it the easternmost part of Western Massachusetts. I think that's a fair and accurate description. It's also known as Apple Valley. I live a few miles from, you know, where Johnny Appleseed once lived and spread his seeds. And there are apple orchards all around me and Civil War monuments and stone walls. Everything you think of like picture book New England, that's my backyard. That's where I live. And it's lovely. But it's small, and our downtown is like five buildings. There's downtown, and among them, there's an entrepreneur named Marco who's opened up not one but multiple restaurants downtown, and one of them is a casual restaurant. And he started this thing, and it's still in progress, $5 hamburgers on Wednesdays.
Hmm.
So it's a $5 burger, any topping you want. He puts the, you know, he calls it within reason. So. But you want cheese, you want lettuce, tomatoes, you want mushrooms, you want barbecue sauce, you want bacon, he'll do it. Plus fries, $5, and he only asks that you buy a drink, and you don't even have to buy an alcoholic beverage. You could buy seltzer water if you want, a soda. He doesn't care, $5. Now, I've been thinking a lot about this because as a way of selling burgers, that's pretty expensive. I don't know how Marco makes it up. Does he make it up in the drinks he sells at night? You know. I don't know. I don't know if he even breaks even on Wednesdays. But I've been thinking about it, and I realize, wow, it may be an expensive way to sell a burger, but it sure is a cheap way to get the word out and to draw attention. Everyone in town knows about the $5 burgers. People come from outside of town for the $5 burgers on Wednesday night. And so this has led me to think, Tom, and this is something I want to talk to my fellow marketers about. You know, we spend so much time thinking of messages, trying to think of clever ways to package the same old stuff, when really what we should be thinking about is, what's our $5 burger? What's that one little thing that we can do that gets people to sit up, pay attention, and talk? That, to me, is interesting. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in working with clients to say, what's your $5 burger? What's the thing you're going to offer that makes people sit up and pay attention and generates momentum on its own? That's where the magic is, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a good lead magnet or a tripwire. You know, the $5 could be just a tripwire to, like you said, an upsell or just a lead magnet. You know, if someone will come again and again and tell people. I mean, it's just a beginning of a funnel, and if it's working for him, it's great. I think Subway did that too, right? Like the $5, like footlongs or something for a while. I don't know.
Yeah,
he just borrowed that idea, and it's great. It's working. I mean, I would rather get a burger than a Subway.
And what's great too is I think that it's something people will talk about, like in town. You say, you know, people, it's become a thing now. What are you doing Wednesday night? Let's meet up at Marco's, right? I mean, that's the kind of energy an idea like that can generate, where no amount of messaging can really quite get that kind of excitement. It's like, okay, here's another clever message. All right, for what it's worth. But you got that thing, an offer like that, and people will do the talking for you because they're excited about it. I don't know that it's easy to always find what that $5 burger is, but I think it's worth considering and thinking about it. I mean, for Apple, let's face it, Apple was resurrected on a very expensive hamburger, you know, the iPod, right? The music thing. And people forget that. You know, Apple, what Jobs did was transform a company from a computer company into a consumer products company. And he led it with this little tiny device that happened to be exactly what people wanted. And it saved Apple and made them what they are today, this, you know, gigantic, megalopical, you know, near monopolistic consumer products company, for better or worse. But I think that that was a kind of insight that Jobs understood. You know, bake it into the product itself. Bake the excitement into the product itself. And I wish I could see more marketers involved in the front end in the product itself rather than just after the product's done, the product management team comes to the marketers and saying, here's our pig, put the lipstick on it, you know? There's got to be a better way.
What is the difference when you work with the small companies like Marco and these huge companies like Apple? Because, you know, I've seen a client list. Like, you're doing both. You have some power hitters on that list.
Right. Don't be too impressed, Tom. Remember that when I have the power hitters on the list, I'm not the agency of record, right? I'm not their agency of record. I don't do the brand work. I'm doing pickup work that the agencies don't want to do, and I'm quite comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, some of these clients, like Harvard Business School, will talk to me about strategy on certain specific areas, and we can have those kind of conversations. Excuse me, but most of the time, you know, when you see the big names on that list, I'm going to just be really honest to people. You know, it's picking up obscure projects that fall through the cracks. They're too complicated for in-house staff to do, and they're not really part of the bailiwick of the official agency of record. That's why I do a lot of content with them, you know, white papers, e-books, et cetera. But the difference between, you asked, well, working with small and working with large, and the biggest difference is large clients will have a professional marketing staff, which makes my life much easier. I don't have to teach them what an offer is. I don't have to explain the basic fundamentals of how the stuff works. They understand what a creative brief is. They understand what I need to get started. They understand how to give feedback. When you work with smaller businesses, you got to do a lot more hand-holding. In terms of how much strategic input I have, you know, I don't know that there's any meaningful difference. That is, I don't know that the small guys will give me more room to roam than the big guys necessarily. It's entirely about the temperament of whomever I'm working with. So either way, it could be a person who's conservative who just wants to say, look, you know, I want a 500-word article, that's what it is. And then there's someone else who's saying, you know, yeah, we're open to some ideas about how to better reach this audience on terms that matter to them. What do you think, Jonathan? There's just no consistency. It's all over the place.
Got it. What would you say to like a regular small business, what would be the number one page on their website that they should pay someone to write copy for? If there was any of those.
Oh,
yeah.
It's got to, well, yeah, I'd say, look, it's got to be the homepage. I mean, it's got to be the pages you anticipate people are going to arrive at first. Now, I know, if you have 100 pages, it could be any of those 100 pages. But we know in reality, that's not true, right? You know, we know what the big traffic ones are going to be. They're going to be the homepage. They're going to be the About Us page if it's B2B particular, probably not B2C as much. It's going to be the high-level product and service pages, you know, the high-level navigation pages that introduce subsets, right? And what I often say is that if you're looking to save money and you're budget conscious, get the professionals to work on that set of 3 to 5 really core pages, and then you can wing the rest, which often are just very technical anyway, you know, product descriptions, service descriptions, or their lists of press releases, articles, et cetera. They may not need the attention of a pro, but I'd say the pages where you anticipate traffic, damn, make sure those are fantastic.
What's your favorite book on copywriting? If you have one.
Oh, that's easy. Yes, that's easy. Tested Advertising Methods by John Caples, written almost 100 years ago. I mean, I'm exaggerating. When did that book come out? In the 40s, 50s? I forget. John Caples was a master direct response writer. And Tested Advertising Methods has this intimidating title, but it's really about copy. And he was speaking to a world in which direct response was a major, was a widely understood mechanism. It's less understood today because of the way that digitization has obscured the process. But it's no less relevant. Caples was just brilliant about cutting through the nonsense and talking about the absolute necessity of speaking to directly to customer needs, speaking to what's urgent, to teasing out interest, to being specific with facts and figures. There's no doubt about it. I'd recommend anyone interested in copywriting to start with John Caples.
What sort of training did you do? Most of the people that I know always tell me to write like an hour of copy per day. Like, what was your training like?
Well, I came from an unusual angle at this. I think most of the people who go freelance started as either working in-house in a marketing department or working on the agency side. And I started without either experience. I just put my shingle out as a copywriter. And the context was I had just completed graduate school, an MFA, Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, and I had a brand new baby daughter, and I had to make a living. And I started doing research about, well, where can I do commercial writing? And this is, you know, like 1995. We're going in the Wayback Machine now. And through the research, I arrived at a couple of conclusions. One was that the closer you are to the dollar, the more money you can make. And this is incredibly important. All you future commercial writers out there, keep this in mind. The more your work is directly tied to gaining revenue, the more money you will make writing, period. Never forget that. That's incredibly important. That insight ultimately led me to direct response, where copywriting really matters. It's not nice. It matters. You can actually measure the impact. The second thing, what was the other thing I learned? The other thing I learned is that it would be as much work for me to try to get a full-time job as it would be to go independent. You know, I'd have to pull together a portfolio. I'd have to network. I'd have to do all that. And I said, you know, one day, my brother had been kind enough to buy me my first decent computer. It was a Pentium 75, and I was so excited by it. You know, I entered the modern world. And one day, I'm sitting, and I'm looking at this computer, and I realized, holy mackerel, this computer is an office in a box. It's a tool for creating the work. It's a file cabinet for storing the work. It's a communications device through fax and email for sharing that work. It's an accounting device for tracking invoices and money inputs, et cetera, et cetera. And I suddenly realized, well, why do I need an employer? If I'm willing to go out and get clients, I could work on my own. And out of that impulse, I went on my own, and I'd say that first year I really spent figuring out what exactly kind of work would I do. Because at the time I thought, would it be technical writing? Would it be commercial writing? Would it be public relations? Would it be marketing? I didn't know. By the end of the year, I knew that it was going to be primarily direct response with pickup of public relations work, which is basically ghostwritten articles. Over time, that morphed into content writing, which is about 9/10 of what I do today.
Interesting. Yeah, before the call started, you know, we talked about Skype breaking down, and you mentioned that you think the age of innovation is over, right? And since you kind of went with the Wayback Machine, and the innovation's been moving so fast. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, I think someone pointed out to me about a month or so ago, says, look, it's been about 10 years since we've seen the launch of something like a Facebook or Google, something that made you go, wow, this is new. And I thought, that person's right. We haven't seen, anything big. We got the smartphones now. We got the social media platforms. We got all kinds of tools for video and whatnot. It's been a while since we've seen a digital development that made us sit up and go, isn't that interesting? Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't developments in progress, but the new areas of developments in progress, and think about what they are: artificial intelligence, machine learning, Internet of Things, deep analytics, big data, right? I mean, I don't know if you agree, like those are the five like big exciting things going on in digital. And what they all have in common is they're extraordinarily complex, and they're going to take like a moon launch level of investment before they can turn to something useful or meaningful. They require the big bucks, which means that these are going to be initiatives launched by the very largest companies. They're not going to be the startup entrepreneurs in a garage, or even entrepreneurs in Mountain View with a bunch of VC guys, drinking their Pinot Noirs, etc. This is a whole different level of game, and it's going to change the environment dramatically because the returns are going to be further out than before, because this is no longer just about an app on a smartphone, you get immediate returns. This is going to take longer, and it's going to be a different kind of environment. The second thing is, Tom, look at the business model now. Basically, Google, Apple, Amazon, they sit back on the heels, and they look at the little guys to see what the little guys come up, and if they see something interesting or threatening, they just buy it. Okay, they just buy it. They say, and that's become a model. That's become the dominant exit strategy for a startup. It's no longer, it hasn't been IPs and going public for ages, right, since the last crash. So the model is, let's make something interesting enough that someone wants to buy us. Okay, but what does that mean? You just said yourself, since Microsoft bought Skype has been kind of not as great as it once was.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And it's not a surprise because it's no longer a core business. They don't care. So when you say, why do I think innovation isn't what it used to be? It's because of those forces. One, the new areas of innovation are just going to be so much more expensive and involved. And number two is that the model, even for smaller levels of innovation, has changed, where it's the biggest players just gobble up everything. They're sitting on gigantic piles of cash. Capitalization is at record level, record lows. Money is so cheap, and with the tax cut that Trump gave them, people are sitting on even bigger piles of cash. They don't even know what to do with all their cash. Honestly, they literally don't know what to do. I mean, this is like, where do we put all this stupid money?
Yeah.
I don't know, but so they're buying up all this stuff. What that means is there's less and less competition, which means for us on the consumer end, we're going to see, if there's less competition, there's going to be less innovation. The proof of this is, think about your cable TV. Think about your cable TV and how crappy your cable TV service is.
I've just dealt with this with my parents. I went to see them maybe 3-4 months ago, and they were just trying to get away from their $100 cable bill. Because my mom watches two TV channels, like not even.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And where do you folks live?
Well, they live around Chicago, so they only have...
Okay, great.
They only have
two
one... one choice, right. They told me, if they want to get actual cable. The other choice is on the internet. So it's through it's through the internet.
Exactly. And that's the whole joke, right? We're told that we have all these choices, and then, in fact, we really don't. Like, so my cable choices, I go back and forth, Verizon, Comcast. And you'll notice too, Tom, each of them keeps changing the names. It's like, it's Xfinity, it's whatever, it's Fios, it's, to almost like to confuse us, to make us think, oh no, they're different and new. And it's really no, it's the same old crap, different package. And we'll sign you up. And within months, the service will be as lousy as your previous service. And there's nothing you could do about it. I mean, it's really absurd. At this point, if this world were just, we'd have municipal Wi-Fi. And this wouldn't be a private enterprise at all. It'd be treated as a utility, which is what it should be, but it's not. But that's the way it is, because it's the cheapest thing of all are politicians, and because it costs so little to get them to do what you want them to do, that's an investment an extraordinary return. So why invest in technology? We can invest in a politician, and you get your turf and a virtual monopoly, and then where does innovation go?
Well,
nowhere.
With the innovation, so I agree and don't agree with you. I agree that a lot of my friends, when they're starting businesses, they're all thinking about an exit pretty much. You know, that's the main thing. So even when we just talk about like a new thing that we're doing, we always look for two things. What's the market cap and which company can afford to buy us out? And if we can't find one, it means maybe we shouldn't start something in this industry.
Well, that's right.
Which, you know, is maybe not the most promising trend, but that's what's happening.
Right.
But when we do have innovation, like I've seen a new episode of Vice, and they were talking about the 3D printing. And ever since the patents kind of died out, some of the things they're doing is incredible. The other thing I've seen a lot of my friends go into and get rich is crypto, you know, just starting all type of crypto startups. And that's the one thing that's kind of beyond, you know, the regular market, but it's innovative. And it's, some of them are saying that
is it innovative or is this crypto just the latest Ponzi, you know, thing that's just going to blow up in a couple of years or even 6 months?
So the technology, in my opinion, the blockchain, there are some innovative things that can be used with the blockchain. The crypto itself, most of them are Ponzi's, but, you know, I've worked with both, and some of the people actually trying to make a difference, they hate the crypto part, you know, the speculation, because it's actually messing up their businesses. But I think, you know, it is getting innovative. You know, it's not stagnant. It's not something that a lot of companies are buying up yet. I don't know.
Well, you know, I like to think about it as the gold rush, right? Who got rich in the gold rush?
Well, it's always the people selling the shovels. It's always the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, what's so funny is that I have an acquaintance who literally, I'm not kidding, used to manage the shovel collection at Stonehill College in Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
And what it was that was the legacy of the Ames family, A-M-E-S. The company is still in business. They still make shovels. I don't know if it's a family business anymore. It may just be a brand that's owned by a larger company. But, yes, Ames made a fortune selling supplies, right, to the people go out to dig gold. I think well, how about the people actually finding gold? I think more of their bones bleached in the sun than they ever received, you know, made any money or found gold. And I suspect that a lot of the crypto stuff is going to be the same thing. There's going to be some people who are going to make a lot of money, but they're going to make their money off the people trying to make money off of crypto.
Yeah,
right?
It's true. That's true. Yeah. Like I said, you know, some of the technology is innovative, but crypto definitely has a dark side to it too. And I've seen both sides. So you know, I'm split on crypto itself, but I do see enough innovation where I can say, you know, there are things happening.
Right.
You know, speaking of innovation, are you seeing any trends in copywriting? You know, what has changed since you started? Are you seeing anything happening that's a little different, maybe that you wouldn't expect?
A couple of things. And again, this isn't scientific. This is very anecdotal, very, very subjective. I see some good things and I see some bad things. I guess I should start with the bad. And the bad is that we have a generation of younger marketers. Take a marketer today in his or her 30s, right? I'm going to call her. She has not. If she's in her 30s, that means that she came of age, you know, in the aughts in the 90s, right? And that's putting it way back when she was a teenager in the 90s, came of age of 20s in the aughts, and then now in the 2010s is in her 30s. She's grown up in a digital environment, right? The discipline of direct response marketing is ancient history to her, right? It's all, and then digitized environment, it's all about metrics by views, opens, click-throughs, downloads, etc. So what are the consequences of this? Well, a couple things I've noticed. People don't know how to make offers anymore. If you were raised like myself, if you learned direct response copy rule methods, you understood that offer was the number one most important thing, right? Offer list, format, copy. That was the golden rule for the level of, for impact. In that order, offer is the most important. Fewer people today know how to write a freaking offer. They don't know what to do. How do you write a call to action? They don't know what to do. I see, and what my, I guess my long-winded point is that because of the changing environment, there are young people who haven't mastered the basics of copywriting that once were just taken for granted that you knew this. Those have been lost, and as a consequence, we're seeing a lot of writing that misses the mark. It may be clever, it may be erudite, it may be very sophisticated, but it could be lacking in that. I see too much content where there's no sense of, well, what's the next step? What do you want people to do as a consequence of this content? Where is the next step? That's the bad side. On the good side, what's interesting is that formality has just gone out the window, right?
Mm-hmm.
Video. Remember, there's always been video. It was, and the name of it used to be called industrial films or industrial movies, right? This has always been a thing where, you know, the bar was extraordinarily high. Only the richest companies could afford to make an industrial film, and then to distribute it, you didn't. There was no broadband. There was no internet. So it was the kind of thing you would produce. You'd do it a sales presentation. You show your 10-minute movie, right? So the bar has dropped. Anyone can make video. And what's kind of cool is the standards, the production value standards have dropped. And that's actually a good thing. Look at that guy, Gary Vaynerchuk.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, especially the first year or two of his stuff, he can't even get the color correction right on his video.
Right.
The audio is a mess. I mean, it's a disaster. Didn't matter. Why? Because he was so compelling as an entertaining presence. Because the content was so rewarding, people were so interested in what he had to say about wine, that the production values didn't matter. And that is, I guess that's my point, that what I'm seeing is that because the production thresholds have dropped, there's been an opportunity to play with content and to focus on the substance of the thing without worrying about ultimate production values. Take blog posts, for example. We don't even blink now when we, you know, spelling errors, grammar errors. We expect a kind of casualness, and that can be great because it just like it's so instead of talking down our audience, it's more shoulder to shoulder, like colleagues, right? I like that. I like that there's a lot more informal communication back and forth, relationship between a company and its market, between a customer and the person selling. I think that's a great thing. It's especially good for marketers, and there's some that are absolutely brilliant at building, you know, relationships with their audiences, and I think that is great. I like that a lot. And I also kind of enjoy some of the cheekiness of contemporary advertising. When you see things like you take a brand that had been moribund, like, the cologne, come on, help me. What's the name? You know, Old Spice.
Mm.
Old Spice. That was like your grandfather's aftershave, right? Who the hell wore Old Spice? And then they come up with this, and then they make these outrageous ads that have nothing to do with cologne or anything like that, but they simply say one thing. We're kind of cool and hip like you are. And if you're like if you get this ad, if you understand why this is funny, this is a scent for you. And it works. And it's brilliant. There was something else I saw recently that was like, wow, that was really cool. Now, of course, you know, I'm contradicting myself because if I can't remember the brand, how good could it have been? But it was. And you have to remember, I'm 55 years old. So, I get license here. And now I can't remember. But I remember seeing this ad. I thought, wow, that is pretty damn cool, and we would not have seen that 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So the answer to your question is that we're seeing that copywriters have so much more liberty for play. Sometimes it doesn't work, but when it does, it can work big and create things that are memorable that people will talk about. So that's how I think copy's changed.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. A lot of people trying to be entertaining, and they forget to sell.
Yeah.
For sure.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen that. I've seen so much
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely.
But then, I don't know if you heard of Billie Jean, but he's, in my opinion, one of the best YouTube ad guys in the world, right? And he's super entertaining in the first 30 to 45 seconds. But then for the next 2 minutes, he keeps screaming for you to push the button to whatever he wants you to go to. And he'll keep reappearing right. and just say, push the goddamn button. And like, why haven't you pushed it yet?
That's
and, you know,
hilarious.
He gets the call to action, right?
He gets it. He gets it. You know, one of my kind of marketing heroes is Ron Papil. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy, Ron, you know, he's the guy with the rotisserie oven. He's the veggie chop-o-matic. He's the fisherman, the pocket fisherman. And I advise everyone, look at what he does. Look at how that works. Ron Papil's family grew up. They were the kind of salespeople you'd see on the boardwalk in Atlantic City or Wildwood, New Jersey. They understood how to grab people's attention, suck them in, create an entertaining showcase, and move product. One of the things, in fact, I recently had this precise conversation with a client. I said, look, if you watch Ron Papil's pitch, where he has a thing, he has an audience, a live audience. He has like a theater where he's on the stage. Notice he's never on that stage alone. There's always someone next to him who acts kind of like the Greek chorus in ancient Greek tragedy, someone who voices the skepticism and concerns of the audience, saying, Ron, you can't cook that chicken in 20 minutes. And Ron says, yes, I can. And the person says, that's got to be hard and complicated. I'll never be able to do something like that. And Ron says, this is what you do. See this? You stick it in the chicken. You stick it in the box. Press the button. It's that simple. Set it. Forget it. And then the person goes, oh, my God, I can't believe how easy it is. Yes, it is. And then they go on to something else. Ding. The alarm goes off. They taste the chicken. And then then Ron hands that person a piece of chicken. The person goes, oh, my God, that's the most. Oh, my God, it's delicious. Now, what is that person doing? That's a role. And then Ron Papil's genius is he recognizes that you have to have a role of someone who expresses the skepticism of the audience and then converts, has that religious experience, right, and converts.
Yeah.
So I encourage my clients to say, create that character in your marketing somehow. You got to have that. There's got to be that voice of skepticism that anticipates the objections of your market, who voices them and gives you a chance to counter, and then we want to watch that person convert. Do that.
Yeah, it's one of the oldest rules of copyright. In the beginning of whatever you're doing, you have to get into the mind of your prospect and meet them
absolutely
where they are and continue from there. And mm-hmm. and yeah, then the objections, you got to handle the objections. And if you have someone else throwing them at you, it's even better.
That's even better.
That's even better. Yeah, and at the end,
that's much better.
You just show the final product. You make
exactly.
someone imagine how great it would be to have that, or you know, to gain it, and you sell. Yeah, don't forget to sell.
Exactly. Don't forget to sell. And another thing about Ron Papil that I like is that he's actively involved in the design of the products he sells. And he understands to design, he bakes the sale into the product. For example, that rotisserie chicken. He made sure there were like just two buttons on the damn thing. Simple. He wants it simple. He wants to make the message he wants to get at is set it and forget it. So he says, everything's got to be simple. I just want like three buttons. That's it. He also insisted that the front be almost all glass. He wanted the visible space. He wanted visibility into whatever food you're cooking because he understood that was the sensual appeal. He wanted people to see the cooked chicken and the juices coming down off the roast. He knows that you want that visual feedback and assurance. This is going to be delicious. The marketing is built into the product. And one of the things I often feel that I wish people would contact me earlier. You know, The product's already built. The thing's designed. Jonathan helped me sell it. Gosh, I wish I had the opportunity to come in a year or two earlier and have that and be able to sit around a table with a bunch of people and say, oh, you're designing this? Let's talk about how we bake the marketing into the actual product design itself.
Yeah,
and then 50% of the work is already done for you.
Yeah, that's super interesting. You know, it sort of reminds me of those food stands in front of Home Depot. You know, you might get a shitty sausage, but the smell of the onions, which they have figured out, they will definitely drive you to that sausage. It might not be great at
absolutely.
The end.
Absolutely.
But the marketing is the marketing is done for sure. and they get you at the best spot too, man. Right? You're probably running for that last piece of item to finish your work. You're starving, and you're like, you know what? I can't. I need to get something to eat.
You just need something now because you're not going to have a chance later. You're exactly right. That's perfect opportunism, right? Because, you know, I've been that guy at Home Depot where you're desperate and you realize, oh, my God, it's 2 o'clock and I haven't had lunch yet because I've been elbow deep in fixing the plumbing, right? And you're at Home Depot and you're just like, I'm starved. You smell, like you said, you smell the sausage, you smell the peppers and onions. Like, just give me the damn thing. I'll be done with it, right? That's a good point. Good point.
Jonathan, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
Where can people find you?
Well, people can find me. You know, here's an interesting conclusion. Obviously, they could find me. They do a Google Jonathan Kranz. They come to my website, kranzcom.com. And if I encourage people who want to contact me, fine. Send me email. But you know what's happened is LinkedIn has become everyone's Rolodex.
Mm-hmm.
I just did business cards. I don't even put my phone number and my email address on them. Why? Because I know that people won't use them anyway. What they're going to do now is people use LinkedIn as an automatically updated Rolodex. So, you know, connect to me on LinkedIn, everyone. You'll find me there. Everyone finds everyone on LinkedIn, and you can ask, you know, to be connected, et cetera. That's a perfect place to find me.
Awesome.
Thank you, Tom. This has been wonderful. Really enjoyed this.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect, Liebelt. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.